Welcome to this week's episode of Straight Talk with Euripsy Morgan. It has been a very interesting week, a very global week, with the announcement of a new pope.
Many people thought this extraordinary moment would never happen. An American, now the leader of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics for the first time.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
So, confession, I am actually not a Catholic, but even I thought this was pretty fascinating for a number of reasons, but apparently it was not expected that there would be an American pope. I'm going to talk about that in just a second, but here's what I noticed right off the bat. So, we had Trump's 100 days in office, I believe it was last week or just very recently. We know that the election was very, very political, very, very divided, and sometimes it feels like America just could not be even more divided, which we know historically is not the case. There have been times in our history where we were like literally more physically and politically divided. But yet you have elections like this and folks are threatening that they're going to move to Canada or, you know, like I'm done with America until we get a new American pope. And all of a sudden it's like American pride is back. All of a sudden people are excited to be Americans and it's, you know, red, white and blue, this and that. Because not only is this guy an American pope, but he is from Chicago. He's a baseball fan. He went to Villanova. He's got a math degree. It's very American of him, right? But what I find really interesting are kind of the politics of what goes on behind the scenes in the conclave. Like many folks, you know, the last pope, I forget when he was elected, but I remember being, I mean, I was obviously old enough to where I was watching the news, but not really understanding what was going on. And this time it felt like it was more of a draft. Like people who were not Catholic, who had nothing to do with the church, were interested in what was going on because all of a sudden it was like, what do you mean we do smoke? Like it's like a gender reveal, except for a pope. And then when it was announced that it was American, it's like, hey, hang on a second. Now, I was doing some reading about why I was honestly surprised that there hasn't been an American pope, I guess, ever. And that just feels very odd to me. I don't know. Maybe that's my Americanism coming out and the fact that, what do you mean we're not always picked? It kind of feels like, you know, when you have to do the drop downs for like what country you're from and the U.S. is not automatically listed first. Why? And I get it. There are, you know, several hundred other countries, but still, it feels very much like, what do you mean we're not the first? So anyways, now we have an American pope. What I was fascinated by, though, were the reactions globally as to what this means and the concerns. So apparently, like I said, it's very draft style, you know, where you've got these different cardinals and everybody was talking about who the front runners were and, you know, who the top picks were going to be. And apparently this guy was like, nowhere near the top. There was one article, I think, by Axios, who did talk about this specific provost, who then now is the pope. And please forgive me if I get the terms wrong. Like I said, I'm not Catholic, but I'm trying here. And so there was this one article in Axios explaining why it was very unlikely that we were going to have an American pope. And one of the reasons was because of the U.S. global influence and that it was likely seen that the Catholic Church would not want to have that global that U.S. influence on the church. And also, I think a little bit of like, you guys have everything anyways, so why do you need a pope? Kind of like if the homecoming queen gets elected prom queen too. Don't you have enough already? However, apparently this guy's background, you know, they go in and they vote and the white smoke comes up and if they haven't picked somebody. So it was a whole interesting process that I think a lot of non-Catholics and just a lot of people in general, and maybe with the advent of social media becoming so big, suddenly we were kind of drawn into it because it was very draft style and it was very interesting. But I find the argument that there were concerns about giving the U.S., a global superpower, even more power, very, very interesting. And I find it interesting because it's kind of like the opposite has happened. It sounds like maybe now that was not the top concern, but rather some hope. And again, this is all just speculation, right? We're just speculating. I was not at the conclave. I don't know what went on behind closed doors. But there seems to be now some idea that maybe the opposite could be true, that rather than the U.S. politics influencing the church, that the reality that this is an American Pope who speaks English, right? Like, when they're out there speaking Latin, we can, most of us can kind of ignore it because, like, I don't know what you're saying. So you could be telling me you hate me or you tell me you love me. I have no idea what you're saying. But generally speaking, you know, they were, like, over there. They were in Europe or they were in Central or South America, you know, and they were speaking in Latin. And so generally speaking, I think American politics could somewhat ignore what was going on or what they were saying, the criticisms, right? But the idea now is that since this is a U.S. Pope from Chicago speaking English, that rather than U.S. politics influence the church, that there may be some church influence into U.S. politics. So Vice President J.D. Vance is a practicing Catholic. There have been apparently a couple of times. So this Pope has maintained a, it's a very mild social media presence, allegedly, right? Because we don't, I guess there hasn't really been any confirmation that that was his Twitter or his social media, but I think he's had it for more than a decade. So that would be very weird if it wasn't his social media. And apparently he has made some subtle criticisms of the Trump administration's stance on mass deportations. Now, that should not be new to anybody. I mean, again, I'm not a Catholic, but you know what the Catholic Church teaches, right? And particularly when it comes to immigration and embracing the lost and the poor. I know in my practice as an attorney, I have found some of the biggest advocates for the immigrant community are Catholic charities, Catholic churches, right? They are some of the biggest advocates for helping with food and resources, driver's license, things like that. So while they're not necessarily politically active, they tend to kind of take on the, you know, regardless of politics, this is our stance and we will help in X, Y, and Z way. So J.D. Vance, you know, being a Catholic, I guess he posted something not too long ago about a specific Catholic canon and, you know, a priority. I don't know, but it had to do with immigration. And this Pope, prior to him being named Pope, disagreed with J.D. Vance's position. And so I wonder now, because like I said, in the past we've been, I mean American politics have been able to ignore criticisms from the Catholic Church because we didn't know what they were saying. In large part, they were over there. Like, Donald Trump doesn't speak Latin, you know? I don't think he was very interested in what they were saying. This guy's in Chicago. I mean, not physically in Chicago, but he's from Chicago, okay? He's like a family. I think he's a White Sox fan. God bless him. I'm a Rangers fan, but I won't hold that against you. But he is going to be, I think, more difficult for American politics to ignore. Now, of course, we have separation of church and state. So that's not to say that the Pope will have an outsized influence or even that the Pope should have an influence. But I think if he chooses to make any criticisms of Trump's deportation policies or any of any president's policies, because remember, this is an appointment for life and the guy is 69. So, that's not... He could be around for a long time, all right? You know, he will be around longer than, any four-year term, presidential term, unless, you know, something happens. But he's going to be around a while. So how he chooses to play his influence and whether or not he chooses to make his opinions known, especially when they conflict with what the president is doing. And I'll just touch on this very briefly. In this past week, there have been a lot more visible confrontations with ICE and detainees. And I believe even the mayor of Newark, was arrested at a detention center. They were protesting at a detention center. And you're going to start to see a lot more of these clashes. And because we use social media so much in our lives, you can go on YouTube and Instagram, on TikTok especially, and see these images of people being taken, detained. There was a woman recently who had an infant in her arms. And you're going to start to see more and more of this as the Trump administration continues to ramp up and continues to aggressively encourage deportation, right? And now they're doing this voluntary deportation, where I believe they're offering $1,000 for voluntary deportation, which from a financial perspective makes a lot more sense. And I do think that there are going to be a significant amount of people who take that and say, all right, but so much of what we're seeing, and when you get these ICE agents, a lot of them, you know, and I understand, right? I get why they do some of the tactics that they do when they come in and they've got their protection, and they come in with a big force. A lot of it has to do with their own safety and their own protection, because let's be honest, people don't like seeing that. And so there's the tendency for violence to happen, violence against them. So I get it. I get it. But it's a really bad look. And people really, I think, are starting to get a little bit more outspoken about the nature of how these deportations are happening. And so as that ramps up, and because it conflicts, I think, so much with how the Catholic Church tends to treat the plight of immigrants, I think you're going to see the potential for maybe more criticism. From this Pope, but, you know, like I said, I guess we'll wait to see. And I'd be very curious, especially from J.D. Vance, who is a practicing Catholic, how much of that influences his policy decisions going forward. Thanks for listening to Straight Talk with Europe C. Morgan. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel and add this podcast on Spotify. If you're enjoying the show, consider subscribing to my Patreon to help keep the lights on around here. Just $5 goes a long way. Go to patreon.com/whymorganshow today. And don't forget to tell a friend. Now, on to the next global issue that went on this week. There was the announcement by the White House of a new trade deal with the UK. Listen to this.
Yesterday, President Trump demonstrated the art of the deal and secured a historic trade agreement, despite all of the naysayers who said no deals were coming. That, of course, turned out to be untrue. On the 80th anniversary of Victory Day for World War II, President Trump announced a great deal that provides American companies unprecedented access to the UK markets while bolstering US national security.
Look at him, this. He is a master promoter. The date on which this fell, I'll give it to you. That is a stroke of genius, you know. It gives it a very, like, see, this is a great thing. Remember when we ended this war and now we're doing this and it's all on the anniversary of, and it feels very like, yeah, I think I'm supposed to like this, right? And then we get into the details of what this actually means. And listen, I was not one of those people that was saying that there wasn't going to be any deals, that there were not going to be any trade deals. I'm still wondering if this is a good trade deal for Americans. So I'm not 100% sure why Donald Trump has this obsession with trade imbalances. So this, let me tell you a little bit of specifics about this trade deal. So it keeps the 10% universal tariff on UK goods. And this is why it's not good for American consumers. It used to be, our tariff used to be around 3%. So that means that if you are buying something, if you're going to Target or you're going to the store and you buy something that was made in the UK, the tariff on that was about 3%. It is now generally, universally, a 10% flat tariff, which means that it is costing more for us to bring in those UK goods into America. And there is this whole theory about, you know, what makes a strong economy. Is it, you know, the tariffs or, you know, GDP, all sorts of things. For whatever reason, Donald Trump seems to be obsessed. Like, he's stuck on this issue of a trade imbalance. The fact that we import, we bring in a lot more things than we sell out, like that we send out, right? And I don't know why he's so obsessed with that, because America is a consumer-based economy. So you know why we import so many things? Because we like to buy things. Walk into any Target, and one of the first things that you're going to see is a whole like section of cheap stuff. You know why they do that? Because they know we'll buy it. Because springtime comes around and it's all of a sudden like these random little $3 ceramics, and I'm walking by and I'm like, as a matter of fact, I think I would like to buy that, you know? And when I walked in to just get something like toilet paper, next thing you know, I'm spending $150 on stuff that I have no need for. Now, hopefully most of you are more disciplined than I am. But you know what? Based on our spending habits in America, I'd say we are not. Most of us like to buy things. And here's the thing about why we are such an import society. We have the money. We have the money to buy things. Whereas other countries don't import as much stuff because they don't have as much spending power. We in America got the credit card. We like to buy stuff. We have the money to buy stuff. And we expect to buy stuff. So we import a whole lot of things. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. So what the president, when he talks about this trade imbalance, I think he's created this picture that we are being unfairly treated because we somehow bring in more goods than we sell to other countries. Now, again, there are specifics about the tariffs. And yes, I do think that there was some unfair behavior going on. But looking at the trade imbalance is the wrong marker, I think, for gauging how strong our economy is. And so specifically with this new deal, it keeps the 10% universal tariff. Like I said, the average used to be about 3%. And exports. Now, here's where things get really interesting because the exports go down to about 1.8% for specific industries. So it used to be 5%. Why is that important? So the specific industries that are affected, one of them is beef, right? So our cattle ranchers in Texas are about to make a whole lot more money because when they were sending their beef to the UK, it was with a 5% tariff. It now is going to be about 1.8% tariff. So that means that they get to export a whole lot more of their stuff while the American consumer gets to import and pay more for UK goods. So if anybody made more money on this, if anybody gets to benefit from this deal, it's the consumers in the UK, not consumers in the US. We're the ones that are still going to be paying more. But here's the president's thoughts on his own trade deal. Listen to this.
I think that it's a great deal for both parties. It's for us. This one just went very smoothly, went quickly and smoothly, and a lot of common sense. We're going to take it to new levels. It's a very big deal right now.
I love the way he talks. It's a very big deal. It was a great trade deal. It went smoothly. We went smoothly for the UK. I mean, their consumers are going to be able to buy more American-made products at a lower price. We are going to be paying higher prices for UK goods. Now, I'm not clear on how much we import from the UK. Like, what are we talking about? Because every time I turn around, every time I look at something, it's made in China. So I'm not exactly sure how much we're importing from the UK. But I can tell you what we are importing is going to cost us more. What they are getting from us is going to cost them less. So somebody did win, and it was not us. And here's the thing about this obsession he has with the trade imbalance and the tariffs and things like that. Why did Donald Trump get elected? It was inflation. It was the economy. And I do think that there's a limited amount of patience. Now, I don't think that he's exactly, I certainly don't think that he's near panic levels like MSNBC is saying, oh my gosh, the price of eggs. And the price of eggs, I swear, every time I go to the grocery store, one minute it's up here, the next minute it goes back down. At this point, you know, I'm looking at the bird flu. Eggs are not my marker. But what I will tell you is that I think that there is a limit to American patience because he was elected to lower inflation. I think he was elected in large part because people were tired of spending gobs of money at the grocery store and being told by Joe Biden that everything is great. Like, what are you complaining about? It's fine. You know, this is necessary. We've got to do this. Home prices was another thing. Used car prices. I mean, during COVID and even sometime after that, I remember it being exceedingly expensive to buy a used car. I actually got rid of my my used car during that time because I was shocked at how much money they wanted. They were going to pay me for it. And I was like, by all means, take it. You know, not a problem. And those were the issues that I think led to a Donald Trump 2.0. The fact that Americans were paying way too much money for basic products. Now, I think that there is a limit because regardless of whether we're paying too much money for the same good because of inflation or because of tariffs, Americans have shown that there is a limit to how much we want to pay for things. And Donald Trump, I think, has not quite, so far he has been able to convince people that this whole trade imbalance and tariff thing is both about lowering the cost of things, but I think it also has to do with the desire to look stronger. And I'll give it to him on that. You know, the fact that Americans, I think for as long as we have, at least the last decade or so, maybe two decades, there has been almost this feeling of decline of U.S. standing in you know, global spheres where, like I said, I mean, Americans like to, and we are a global superpower, okay? So I'm not going to apologize for that. We are a global superpower. But there has been this feeling that our reputation has been on the decline, that, you know, we're always stuck with the bill, that, you know, everyone's always mad at us, like, and we're the ones that have to pay more for everything because we are a superpower. And the first time around, I think Donald Trump was very, very, very good at convincing Americans that he would bring the strength back. And, you know, in a lot of ways he did. And with the tariffs and the trade imbalance, it's that same idea that we are being mistreated and therefore I will fix this. But eventually, I think American consumers are going to say, yeah, but look at my grocery bill. Look at my credit card bill. Still can't buy a reasonably priced house, right? I'm not talking about a mansion. I'm saying like the people who are saying, I want my kids out of my basement. I need them and their spouse to get out of my house and get married and, you know, like buy their own home. But for many people, it's completely out of reach because the factors that are necessary to bring down the cost of things like lumber and groceries are just not there. And I think eventually this idea of this trade imbalance is going to result in a number of Americans saying, look, this isn't what you were hired to do. I don't want UK consumers to be the winners in this. I wanted us to be the winners. So when do Americans get lower prices? Thanks for listening to the show, Straight Talk with Euripsy Morgan here on YouTube. Make sure that you like and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And by the way, you can catch us on Spotify and iTunes. All right, so let's enough talk about tariffs. Let's talk about something a lot more local. This next policy proposal comes from the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, which I don't typically agree with, but this new idea, I think, is actually really fascinating. Listen to this.
On that list is a proposal to ban cell phones in all public schools. The distraction-free policy would take effect next school year and would make New York the largest state in the country with a bell-to-bell ban. Governor Hochul said the plan will help protect children from addictive technology and improve their mental health.
A bell-to-bell ban on cell phones in school. So I guess from the time the bell rings in the morning to the time it, you know, goes off in the afternoon, no cell phones in the classroom. I think this is a great idea and good on her for this. Now, I understand that there's some, you know, criticism, particularly from parents. It's not always just students that are criticizing this. And I want to get to that in just a second. But overall, I think this is a fantastic policy. Now, I am obviously not as young as I used to be. But I grew up in probably the last generation that did not have cell phones readily available to us. The first few cell phones that I remember seeing were still like those big, massive Saved by the Bell, you know, car phones. And pagers were a big thing for us. So, and I know those were banned in schools. We could not have them. We couldn't have them like beeping in class. And anyways, who were we going to call if we got a page? Like there wasn't even a payphone on camp. Or I think there was a payphone, but it's not like you could automatically like, oh, I got a page. Let me respond to them like a text message. It didn't work that way. But since cell phones have become so, so prevalent, we have seen like this addictive nature of you know, everything from sharing stuff on social media. And, you know, I do this too. I share something on social media and I want to see how many likes it got, how many comments it got. I have tried my darndest to keep my kids away from that. Santa this year got them iPads. And now that I think about it, like, what a terrible idea, because they are 10 and 8. So I feel like we did a pretty good job of keeping them away from that stuff. And my 10-year-old has been very persistent. When can I have a cell phone? When can I have a cell phone? And I'm like, well, when you're like 15, so you got some time. And she'll still, you know, she'll bring it up to her friends. Oh, my mom said when I'm 15, I can have a cell phone. And I'm like, well, you're 5 years away. You got some time. But with these iPads, I noticed they have chat features. So the whole, when I was trying to get away from texting, guess what? They're still able to text their friends. So they play Roblox. And what's the other one? Minecraft. their chat features on there. There's ways that they can splice these videos almost like TikTok Lite, you know, for kids, and they can get likes and stuff on that. And I have had such a hard time. Every time I say no to something, it's like, you know, you cut off the head and three more, you know, spring up. And next thing you know, I am now having to try to play Minecraft just to figure out what's going on in this world. So the obsessive nature with cell phones and social media, I think, is a massive distraction for children. So good on Governor Hochul. But as I said, it's not just kids that I think are going to push back on this. In large part, I think you're going to hear from a lot of parents. I want you to listen to this clip. It comes from Laura Melkler, who is the national education writer for the Washington Post. Listen to this.
You know, I think parents have become very accustomed to being able to reach their kids 24/7. And some of them are very uncomfortable with the idea of not having that access. You know, in some cases, I think that they're concerned about just like little things like, hey, I need you to pick up something after school, or don't forget to turn in your science exam or something like that. But in other cases, you actually hear quite a bit parents who are worried about, what if there's an emergency situation? What if, God forbid, there's a school shooting? How will I be able to reach my kid?
Gosh, this is me too. I want to say it's not, but it is. Now, I understand that a lot of parents are going to push back on this. And where there have been these proposals in other states, parents have pushed back because of safety. But here's the thing about that. And I do this as a parent too. You know, like, I want to know where my kids are. I am, you know, their safety is my utmost priority. But we have somehow convinced ourselves in America that we are in more danger than we ever have been. If you talk to, you know, people on the street, oh my goodness, you know, especially when it comes to things like crime and school shootings. But the reality is that we are much safer in America than we were 30 years ago, when kids were allowed to roam the streets until, you know, dusk, until the lights came on. And think about, like, so just, these are stats that came from the FBI crime labs. Violent crimes have fallen by half since 1993. Murder is down by 34%. Burglaries down by 75%. We are actually in a much, much safer society. I think the issue is that it's not so much that the crime has gone up, because it certainly hasn't, it's gone down, but that the crimes have become a lot more visible. So there was this October 2024 Gallup poll about how Americans feel. So this was just last year. And according to this poll, I'm going to make sure that I get the numbers right on here, 40% of Americans, this is the highest in three decades, said that they would be afraid to walk alone at night within a mile of their home. 40%, almost half of Americans. And you know what? When I read that, I was like, that's crazy. That's also me. However, in my defense, I'm more, I don't like street lamps. They freak me out. Ever since I watched The Exorcist as a kid, you know, talk about stuff you shouldn't be doing. I don't like street lamps, so I would not be caught walking around at night. But when I read that statistic, it is because I think, even though crime has gone down and crime has become more condensed in certain pockets, right, in our inner cities and things like that, it's a lot more visible. And especially for parents, I think the number one, or one of our biggest fears, I know one of my biggest fears, are school shootings. And even that, I think, is an example of how we have kind of manipulated the data. So let me just give you these couple stats. So the definition, or here's one of the things that bothers me when we talk about school shootings and mass shootings in particular, is how they are defined. So when I think of a school shooting, I think of what happened in Uvalde, Texas, or Sandy Hook. I think of a crazed, evil, horrific person coming into a school and shooting innocent children. That is not how school shootings are defined statistically. So when we hear these statistics, what they're talking about, how they define a mass shooting, is when four or more people are shot or injured or killed. So four people, and guess where they happen most likely, most often? Places like Baltimore City. You know, so these statistics that are used to bolster this fear about school shootings are not actually defining what you and I are thinking about when we think about a school shooting, but those numbers are used to, like, increase that. And it's all over the news. It's all anybody talks about. And then as a parent, what is the logical response? Well, you're terrified, right? I mean, these are our children. These are our babies. I don't want to send them someplace where they're not going to be safe. And I want to be able to get a hold of them in the event that something happens. But That's where things get really interesting. What is the, in the event that something happens, what's the likelihood that something like that is going to happen? Now, as a parent, you know, it's really hard to say that I would want to put my children in any kind of risk. But that's where putting these things in perspective, I think, is really helpful. So according to the data, we have about 5 million students in American schools. The likelihood of death by a school shooting is 1 in 614 million. You have three times higher chance of getting eaten by a shark. And we're going to the Bahamas this summer, so maybe I should be more concerned about that. But I say that because I think this whole issue of cell phone policies, like I said, you're definitely going to get the pushback from the kids. The kids, like, I want my phone, right? Think about it as an adult. If my boss was like, you have to leave your phone in your car, I'd be like, okay, well, then I will also be in my car. I'm not leaving, right? We are addicted to them. It's where, you know, my emails come from and, you know, phone calls. And what do you mean I can't be on TikTok during the day? How am I going to survive? And so I get it. I get from the kid's perspective. But from the parent's perspective, I think there also has to be a recognition about what it actually means to keep our children safe. And as I said before, you know, I think some of that could be alleviated if we actually looked at the statistics, if we actually asked more questions about the data. So when they reference school shootings, tell me how are you defining school shootings? Because if it's not the, you know, horrific Sandy Hook tragedy that we're all picturing, and there are other numbers that are being, you know, used to bolster that, then let me know so I know how to put my fear in perspective. But, you know, I go back to this question about what is safety, because ultimately from the parent's perspective, from my perspective, that's really my main concern, right? And I would want to be able to get a hold of my kids. And I get that. My kids, like I said, they certainly don't have cell phones, but they do have these little watches, these little gizmo things. I don't know why I got them this. I'll tell you why. Because my now 10-year-old, when she was 8, it's like a switch flipped when she turned 8. And all of a sudden, all she wanted to do was come home, drop off her backpack, and go ride bikes with her friends. You know, and there was the millennial in me that was like, heck yeah, you know, like, go ride bikes with your friends. Like, go, you know, get in some mud. Go, like, do kid things. But then there was, like, the 2023 person in me that was like, is that safe? Should I allow you to do that? And so my first thought was like, yes, you can do that. And I'm going to strap this watch on you that is GPS monitored live time so I can track you like an Amazon package, right? And so I'll know exactly where you are. And looking back, I'm like, was that the best idea? I don't know. But so anyways, my point is, like, I get you. The fear is there. But we've got to, I think we need to kind of step back for a second and ask ourselves, if our point is to keep our kids safe, what is actually keeping them safe? Is it, you know, keeping them from experiencing bad things? Or is it preparing them for the inevitable bad things that are going to happen? And I think it should be the latter, as hard as it is. How does this relate to cell phones? Some of the, I think, pushback that Kathy Hochul is going to get is going to be from the parents who, I think, maybe for a lot of us, we've not put that fear into perspective. You know, it is a dangerous world. You know, I'm not gonna, we all know that. It is a scary, dangerous, cruel world. And I don't know a single parent who's like, heck yeah, you know, I want you to experience all that. But it's not about keeping them from experiencing those things, because they inevitably will. I think it's about teaching them how to deal with those experiences. And we just don't do that as well anymore. You know, like, we try to shelter our kids in so many ways that I think tends to do a disservice to them. So if the reason that the kids have the cell phone in the classroom is not for their safety, but for our peace of mind, are we doing more harm than good? Because what do they have to deal with when they have a phone strapped to their hip? Well, the distractions, the bullying, you know, the inevitable downsides of having a cell phone, the grades, you know, if you're constantly distracted, that I think can be a big problem. I mean, think about what it was like back when I was in school. You know, I mean, we didn't have those distractions. Yes, we did have, you know, probably more bullying and maybe it was more severe. I don't know. But I think as parents, we should maybe recalibrate when it comes to things like cell phones, and ask ourselves, you know, are we trying to keep our kids safer, or are we trying to make ourselves feel like we are keeping our kids safer. Thanks for listening to Straight Talk with Europe C. Morgan. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel and add this podcast on Spotify. If you're enjoying the show, consider subscribing to my Patreon to help keep the lights on around here. Just $5 goes a long way. Go to patreon.com/ymorganshow today. And don't forget to tell a friend.